your source for everything paranormal. Para-X. The views expressed and the opinions given by the individual host and their guests do not necessarily reflect those of Para-X, its affiliates, or its sponsors.
Stirring the Cauldron on the Para-X Radio Network. And now, here's your host, Marla Brooks.
Hey, Merry Meet everybody, and welcome to Stirring the Cauldron. Tonight we're going to be talking about the Martians with my guest, Nick Redfern. Now, you've probably heard him and seen him on lots of shows like on the History Channel and the Travel Channel, National Geographic, and he's also a regular regular guest on Coast to Coast. He's the author of more than 60 books, including The NASA Conspiracies, The Slender Man, The Real Men in Black, For Nobody's Eyes Only, and the book that we're going to be talking about tonight, as I just said, The Martians, Evidence of Life on the Red Planet. So we welcome questions from the chat room. And if anyone is listening in live that isn't in the chat room and you want to join us, come over to paraxradionetwork.com. So, Nick, nice having you back. It's been a long time.
Well, thanks, Mark. Thank you.
Well, you keep writing
good to be back on.
I'm glad you like it. I'm glad you said yes. That's always a good thing.
It wouldn't be good if I said,
Yeah, well, then, yeah, exactly. But maybe you'd run under your breath, but I don't think so at this point. Yeah. So this is a really interesting book, and it's probably good timing that you're here to talk about it, the subject of Mars and Martians and other extraterrestrials, with the Pentagram's UFO report supposedly coming out this week, although I haven't heard anything yet. It's expected that they're not going to admit to aliens, but they also won't definitely say that the UFOs are not alien either. So it's probably going to be just a lot of double talk. But do you believe there is a cover up and that we'll ever learn the truth?
Well, I think to some degree there's a cover up. But I think, you know, when we talk about the government, you know, hiding this or hiding that, I think a lot of people don't realize that, you know, within the intelligence community, you've got like the NSA, CIA, Defense Intelligence Agency, Air Force Intelligence, Army Intelligence, and so on. And very often, these agencies don't share data, particularly if it's a sensitive program that they're working on. So when you get a response from one agency, it doesn't mean that agency B or agency C or agency D may actually be in the loop on something else and the others don't know. So I think when we get this report, which should be coming through at some point tomorrow, I think you're right. I think for the most part, we're going to get an expanded version of what we've actually seen already on the news. You know, and we've seen this footage and all this talk about is it the Chinese or the Russians. I think probably the report is going to be, as I said, an expanded version of something like that. And I think they will open it, you know, to the possibility of something being unidentified. I wouldn't be surprised at all if they don't use that word. I'd be surprised if they didn't use that word. However, I think they'll probably leave terms out like UFO or flying saucer or extraterrestrial, because I think they'll probably try and keep away from anything that's sort of emotive, if you like. But as I said, that doesn't mean you know, there aren't other agencies, you know, maybe 50 feet under the floor of Area 51, you know, and only maybe 40 people know about that particular project. You know, that's one of the things that a lot of people don't realize, that just because one agency says this doesn't mean that agency doesn't say that. So.
And you were just mentioning certain words that they use, you know, flying saucer and everything. And in your book, you talk about crypto-terrestrials. Do you want to explain what that is?
Well, yeah, the term crypto-terrestrial was coined by a guy, a researcher and author named Mac Tonis. And unfortunately, Mac died from a heart condition at a very young age, about, I think he was 30, he was in his early 30s anyway. And he'd written a number of books, one of them called The Crypto-Terrestrials. And basically, this was a sort of fascinating scenario, the idea that as well as having visitations from extraterrestrials from other planets, from other solar systems, he came to the conclusion, or to a deep suspicion, that possibly there was an ancient sort of human terrestrial civilization that existed possibly even not just thousands of years ago or 10,000 years, maybe way beyond that. But that hides from us in stealth. You know, they're sort of impoverished and in their sort of their final, I guess, decades left or centuries left. And but in some respects, they sort of camouflage themselves in kind of like an extraterrestrial angle to hide the fact that some of them, at least, may be from right here on Earth. Which would be an interesting angle, you know. You've got real aliens coming to the Earth, and there may be an ancient human civilization on the planet as well. And that's what Mac was looking into. The more and more he dug into it, the more and more that he felt that that there were these sort of ancient humans that you know, were possibly inhabiting sort of. Deep facilities, perhaps under the oceans and things like that. So, yeah, it's a fascinating, you know, situation. Not only do we have us on planet Earth, we've got extraterrestrials, aliens, and then possibly we've got, as I said, these ancient humans here as well.
Peeling back the onion, layer by layer.
Yeah, it's kind of exactly. But he actually, he sort of really laid it all out really well, you know, the idea of sort of creating, of having the crypto-terrestrials creating sometimes sort of stage-made events to make it look like a UFO event. And again, it sort of camouflages what that group was really doing. So.
I like that thought.
Yeah.
So for thousands of years, Mars and Martians have been written about and worshipped, and in modern times, lots of science fiction has been written. You know, H.G. Wells started it with War of the Worlds back in the late 1890s, and I found that there were 40, at least, movies that deal with Mars, but the earliest one was a silent movie that was produced in 1910 called A Trip to Mars. And what was really trippy is that it can be found on YouTube, and it's really worth watching. It's 4 minutes, and it's very, very funny and very interesting. But then there are shows like My Favorite Martian and The Martian Chronicles, you know, Bradbury's, and cartoon characters like Marvin the Martian. Why do you think Mars is so fascinating and has been for so many years?
Well, I mean, that's actually an interesting question, because if you look throughout our history, you know, we've had this sort of affinity and connection to Mars as long as, you know, as long as there have been civilizations on the planet. I mean, for example, you know, the Egyptians, you know, they had a sort of a fixation on Mars itself. And, you know, and you have, like, for example, ancient Greek. And, you know, they all kind of, over the years, you know, there was various different angles that that Mars was perceived as, you know, like a deity. you know, became known as the, excuse me, and then it was sort of, you know, focused solely on war, and you've got Greece and Rome, you know, and what's intriguing is that if you look a lot of these stories about Mars and the old legends and the mythology and the folklore, you'll see that not only is there this affinity to Mars, but it's almost like we have an affinity to Mars for reasons we don't really understand. It's almost as if, you know, there's something almost sort of inserted into our minds that makes us have this affinity, this sort of connection with Mars, but we don't really understand why we have this connection. Now, you have the other side of it, where you can say for sure as to why that there is a fascination with Mars. And this is because over the last sort of 10, 15, 20 years, a lot of strange anomalies have been found by photographs taken by NASA. Some of them taken by the rover craft, the various ones that sort of just trundle across the landscape. And then you've got other ones that are orbiting Mars. And because so many weird pictures have come back, you know, that has really sort of opened the eyes of not just the UFO community, but also people in the scientific world and the media. You know, when you've got things like the so-called face on Mars and things like that. And it kind of also presents the angle of maybe at one point Mars could have been like us. You know, perhaps something happened to them which, you know, we could go the same way as them one day. You know, if, God forbid, it happened, you know, like a nuclear war or something like that. Mm-hmm. And... you know, when you look at some of these pictures, you know, the photographs, and collectively put them together, it does kind of sound as if there was some sort of disaster on Mars, you know, maybe hundreds of thousands of years ago, possibly, and that today we've got very little left, but we've got enough to make a case that, wow, you know, it really does create this image of an ancient world that's has largely gone. But if we now look into the right place and do the right analysis, you know, we're starting now to see some of these images which seem to be not just what most people say, oh, well, it's like the equivalent of, you know, next door's dog's face on a cloud, you know, that kind of thing. we've all seen pictures like that, but mm-hmm. there's so many anomalies, you know, on Mars that it's becoming more and more difficult to just say it's just, you know, playing tricks on the eye. So.
Well, yeah, and I was going to talk about that anyway, so you brought it up a little earlier, but those were kind of the things that made me really think, because in the book you talk about the artifacts that Martians might have left on purpose on the surface of the planet for NASA to find. And if there is life on Mars and they wanted to make contact with us, you know, I started to think, well, wouldn't there be a more direct way to do so? Or maybe these are survivors of some kind of catastrophic mm-hmm. thing, and they live underground and they're quite primitive and don't have the technological capability to do anything but kind of tease us with little things like that. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a number of theories to explain what may have happened on Mars and what have happened to the Martians, whatever they may have been. Now, for example, you know, if, you know, you've got like a world like Mars and some huge disaster happened, as I said, possibly something like a nuclear war, or one of the other theories because of these, you know, vast craters, one of the theories that could have been sort of like a gigantic meteor strike, possibly in the asteroid belt. Some of them at some point may have broken off from the belt itself and run like a doomsday course for Mars. Something mm-hmm. like that. You know, mm-hmm. when you've got gigantic asteroids all being pulled forward by Mars's incredible gravitational pull, you really would have no way to fight against it. So it's either try and hold it all out, you know, deep underground, even if they had time, you know, to build massive deep underground bunkers, or to do the other alternative, if the Martians were, you know, highly intelligent and they'd already done sort of reconnaissance, secret missions to the Earth, maybe, you know, and possibly led to legends of the gods coming down and that kind of thing. I think that's a possibility, and maybe mm-hmm. they came to here, and that's what I talk about in the book as well, the idea that the Martians could have fled their own world and ended up being sort of like an early human terrestrial type situation, but also, you know, you would have these relics left of the Martian civilization and remains of just, you know, sort of destroyed and pummeled what looks like old buildings and carvings. So I think, you know, we can look at it from that perspective, that something happened and the survivors had the chance and probably worked on it to flee Mars itself. But then you have this really intriguing theory, which I don't rule out at all, is the idea that there could actually be some kind of still surviving Martian civilization. And by that, you know, if in all these pictures we've got from NASA and other agencies around the world, you know, we're not seeing, you know, huge roads and the equivalent of cars and trucks and things like that and planes. So I think we can, not largely, but to a significant degree, we can rule out a lot of the stuff in some of the pictures in terms of, you know, there's not much being seen, but there is some really intriguing stuff, but a lot of it we're not seeing too much on the surface. That makes me think that possibly, you know, if there was this gigantic disaster, then perhaps the Martians really did sort of retreat underground, and maybe they're still down there. I mean, you know, if they were highly advanced, enough advanced, and could quite literally, you know, sort of been hiding out for thousands of feet, you know, below the surface, and have managed to sort of recycle water, air, and survive, it's not against the odds, you know, for something like that to happen.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things we're talking about, that there may have been something catastrophic happening, and because Mars at some point was not a dead planet. It was the red planet, but it wasn't dead. But talking about catastrophic happenings and dying planets, I mean, since Mars is closest to us, are things that we're doing here on Earth affecting the planet in any way, do you think?
If what, sorry? Say that again.
If
that last bit.
Do you think that things that we're doing here on Earth have affected that planet in any way?
Well, it's hard to say, really, you know, but I mean, as far as the whole angle's concerned, you know, if we collectively, you know, we sort of put it together, you know, I think we've got enough data, I mean, you know, to say that it isn't a dead world, you know. I mean, that's a good point that you make, because one of the most important things about Mars is that it has a huge amount of water. Now, that's whether it's in the form of water, vapor, or ice, depending on which part of the, you know, the area on Mars and the temperature. You know, we've got three forms of water on Mars. And what's important, it's not like, you know, pictures have been taken of, you know, puddles of water or anything like that. You know, mm-hmm. we're talking about ancient rivers. We've got a massive amount of water in the form of ice at the polar caps on Mars. I mean, they are almost, you know, sort of like they kind of mirror the North Pole and the South Pole on our planet. And so that's what we've still got that on Mars. And, you know, where there is water, you know, on Earth, there's life. Mm-hmm. So, you know, maybe, hopefully, you know, one day, possibly, even if we find something the size of, you know, like a beetle or an ant, and it was mm-hmm. alive in the water. I mean, that would be a stunning thing. You know, an alien doesn't actually have to look like a, you know, something with a big head and big black eyes, you know, and it's running around wanting to abduct you or whatever. You know, it could, I actually think the possibility could be that if we get to Mars, it may well be that the first thing, the first Martians that we find really could be, you know, like something like a weird little earthworm or something like that.
I kind of so like that image.
Yeah. I mean, some people might be a bit kind of disappointed that it's not like a gleaming flying saucer that comes down, you know, and things like that. But it would still be an amazing thing. So, yeah, I think, you know, when you talk about, you know, Mars clearly still being alive, you know, the it just needs us to do more of the research. And the problem is, you know, the a lot of the pictures that have come back from NASA, NASA sort of hemmed and hawed kind of thing about what they think of some of these pictures, and they're sort of, you know, they kind of go down this pathway of, you know, like I said, with you know, faces in clouds, things like that. But I think the time's coming where it is, you know, it's becoming more and more difficult to keep coming up with these, you know, these explanations that really don't stand up to some degrees. So I think, you know, things like that are important, and why it provokes a lot of intrigue, because, you know, it is our nearest planet. It has water. We've got a lot of weird pictures. You know, we've got what look like the remains of ancient buildings and huge structures, even what look like trees and bushes and possibly even creatures on Mars. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing is, with the probes that have been sent, like to Venus and Mercury and things like that, we just don't get this huge amount of anomalies on any of these other worlds. But we do get all these anomalies on Mars. So, again, I think that's another example as to why and how, you know, we've got a good chance of saying for sure that, you know, that we are talking about a world that's maybe actually far from dead. But, mm-hmm. God, of course, you know, if they've actually seen us land our craft on their world, they may actually not want to meet us. I mean, would we really want to meet us? You know, we'd probably shoot them, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's one of the interesting things. One of the reasons why we're not seeing the Martians may well be because they're trying to do their very best to keep their best away from us. You know?
Yeah, I don't blame them. There's a chat room question. She says, what does Nick think of past ages of global civilizations being wiped out, at least for Earth? Maybe Mars had multiple ages of civilization.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's actually a good point, because, I mean, if, you know, let's hope it never ever happens, but if there was a nuclear war today, which, you know, the main superpowers and the, you know, the other nations that have got nuclear weapons, I mean, the United States, Russia, China, the UK, other nations, you know, the number of nuclear missiles that there are now, I mean, it's literally in the thousands and thousands and thousands. Yeah. And if it was a third world war and, you know, and everybody launched, it wouldn't be like, you know, these propaganda films you can see like on YouTube where they tell the kids, you know, hide under the table. You know, I mean, that hiding under the table would not back then or even now, you know, save anybody. Mm-hmm. I mean, the terrible sort of, you know, disastrous events, you know, this would cause if it was a third world war. I mean, literally every, you know, every city in every major country in the world, you know, would be just gone. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, the population now is probably, it's around about 9 billion. You would probably find a surviving population after 100 years of maybe 3 or 4 million, 5 million. The ones who are left would be irradiated from the radiation and you know, psychological dissolvement, you know, of the mind. And it wouldn't actually take long for the survivors, maybe 200 or 300 years, to have forgotten about our civilization. You know, all they would see would be, you know, these strange pieces of buildings and these tin metal things with rubber tires, you know, not really knowing what they are, but they're just scattered all over the landscape, you know, like cars and trucks. And then another 1,000 years, you know, you could say by then there really wouldn't be anything left at all. It would be, you know, the only thing that would be left would be legends of, you know, people who came before us. And of course, it wouldn't take more than probably 2 decades, 3 decades before, you know, the next generation of kids would be born, not being able to read and write, and then their generation after them wouldn't have, you know, certainly wouldn't have any, you know, ability to read or write. There probably wouldn't be any kind of language because everything's gone. So, yeah, I mean, that's a good question, because not only is it, you know, the kind of thing that could happen, but everything could really be wiped out and almost gone within just a couple of 100 years. Because people may not know this, but if you look at the pictures and the footage of when the two initial bombs were dropped on Japan in Nagasaki and and Hiroshima, those bombs flattened those two cities. Today, those missiles, the power, are actually not tens or hundreds. They're actually thousands more powerful than the ones that that wiped out the two Japanese ones. And I'm not exaggerating when I say thousands more powerful. So if everybody fired, it would just be worldwide disaster. Now, of course, you know, some life would survive, but we'd see a very different world, you know, 1,000 years later. And that being the case, that could have happened on Mars. And, you know, the same power could be applied to, you know, like a gigantic meteor strike or asteroid strike, that kind of thing. But it wouldn't really take too long for a civilization to get wiped out, you know.
Yeah, and that's a scary thought. And I think as far as anything living that would remain here or thrive would probably be cockroaches. You can't get rid of them for any reason, and that's, you know, that's really scary. We're going to go to a break in a couple of minutes, but I just want to, maybe this sounds silly, but it's kind of interesting. Do you know where the concept of Martians being little green men came from?
Well, actually, you know, there's been a lot of debate about that over the years, and the first sort of references to little green men goes round back to about the 1940s. Now, over the time, you know, there've been a few more stories have surfaced in comic books and things like that, you know, from like sci-fi stories from, you know, that you could get off the, you know, the book stands in the 1930s and 40s, that kind of thing. And on some of those covers, you can see them, you know, they are green aliens, that kind of thing. But nobody's really kind of nailed it to the, you know, to the table, so to speak. And we've been able to say that, you know, John Smith came up with that name, you know, that term. Now, we haven't got that yet, but the earliest one I can think of was a strange story from the east coast of England. And it revolves around what's called the Children of Woolpit. And Woolpit, W-O-O-L-P-I-T. Woolpit is a little old English village about 1,000 years ago now, as when it was first put into place. And there's a legend of this young girl and this young boy coming out of the woods, and they were totally both green. And And it was very, it's a very really strange story, the Green Children. If you look up Green Children of Woolpit, you'll see this fascinating story of these Green Children who didn't, they had a strange language, they didn't eat food in the same way we did. One of them died, one survived, and there's been, you know, sort of conversations and debates about, you know, were they just sort of feral children, you know, who got lost in the woods and stayed there and sort of lived with the animals, you know, or were they something extraterrestrial? So, you know, if you're talking about sort of little green men or little green people, in one sense, arguably, you can go right back to this story of the Green Children of Woolpit.
Oh, that's interesting. And, you know, I would be terribly disappointed if for some reason we could just pop over to Mars and not be greeted by little green men. I would think it would, yeah, wouldn't be worth the whole trip. All right, we're gonna take a quick break. So we've got more to talk about on the next half hour. We're going to talk about maybe NASA withholding evidence, maybe the CIA's top secret search, and everything else we can squeeze in. So everybody, hang tight, and we'll be right back.
Stirring the Cauldron will be right back, so don't go away.
If you end up with webbed feet,
remember, you've been warned.
Explore the second edition of the Witch's Oracle deck through 45 innovative cards and enhanced guidebook that peers into the world of the witch. The deck's stunning artwork has a new look and includes 7 brand new inspirational cards. Each card now includes a suggested crystal or gemstone to enhance your reading, as well as a magical incantation that provides energy, reinforces the card's meaning, and helps the desired message to be sent out into the universe. The easy-to-navigate guide also has a new look and offers straightforward, gentle guidance that takes readers through both good times and bad. And now includes a chapter on crystal and gemstone divination by the amazing Nicholas Pearson. The Witch's Oracle. It is a perfect divination deck for witches as well as non-pagans, and is designed to suit both seasoned readers and beginners alike. Find out more about the Witch's Oracle deck at www.marlabrooks.com, and you can purchase the deck from shifferbooks.com, amazon.com, or order a copy from your favorite bookseller.
You've no doubt heard of Tango and Cash, Whiskey Tango Foxtrot, perhaps It Takes Two to Tango. Well, now, on the first and third Thursdays of each month, there's a show called Tango and Friends at 8 p.m. Eastern on the Para-X Radio Network with your host, Bruce Tango. And yes, there will be at least two to tango on each episode, sometimes even more. There's going to be lots of topics and lots of guests you'll all know, and lots of surprises. Tango and Friends, every first and third Thursday of the month at 8 p.m. right here on the Para-X Radio Network.
Welcome back to Stirring the Cauldron. Once again, here's your host, Marla Brooks.
Hi, we're back, and my guest tonight is Nick Redfern, and we're talking about his new book, The Martians. And before we went to break, I mentioned that we're talking maybe about some NASA withholding evidence or secret searches by the CIA. But when we were talking a little bit earlier about the Egyptians, something kind of went through my head, so I'm going to throw this one at you, too. People claim to have seen the likeness of the Egyptian queen, Nefertiti, or however you say it, and a pyramid and a sphinx-like block of stone on the surface of the planet. And if they are really there, theoretically, if it's what people are seeing, it is really those kinds of things, maybe the Egypt we know here on Earth could possibly have been a byproduct of the race of Martians who supposedly fled Mars and settled on Earth because of the way their planet was dying. What do you think about that? To make
sense? Yeah, it does. I mean, that theory's been put forward on a couple of times. You know, the idea of a connection between ancient Egypt, sort of very ancient, you know, maybe even beyond known Egyptian civilizations, and a connection to Mars itself. Now, the reason why I think this began was when in 1975, one of the probes that was taking pictures around the surface of Mars took a number or a couple of pictures of what looked strikingly like a human face, with almost sort of like a headdress around it, and it did sort of provoke parallels with the Egyptian Sphinx, the face of the Egyptian Sphinx, and that's why it became known as the face on Mars. Now, if you look at other sort of anomalies and photographs on Mars, you find other kind of Martian parallels as well. You just mentioned like Nefertiti. She was the wife of a ruler in the 18th dynasty of Egypt, and her name means the beautiful one has come. And Nefertiti, you can actually see a photograph. If you Google NASA Nefertiti photo and sort of squint it with your eyes, you can actually see what does actually look like an image of Nefertiti. It's like a sideways image, and you've got like the tall headgear, and yes, again, like a strikingly female side face. And it looks very much like it, almost you can see, well, you can see like a nose, a mouth, and lips as well. And there's actually another one of these faces on Mars. Everybody, I think, you know, has an interesting thing, you know, an interesting issue along these lines, you know, when it comes to the face on Mars. But what is less known is another one that's known as the crowned face. Now, in many respects, and this may actually surprise some people, that the crowned face, as it's known, is actually far more better photographed and far more striking than the face on Mars that everyone's heard of. And again, if you Google NASA and the crowned face photograph, you'll see this image where and this is one of NASA's own official photographs, and it really does. It's almost impossible to say this is not a carved face. It has what looks like the, you know, like a carved head, two eyes, even with pupils, a nose with two nostrils, right below that, a mouth with lips, and then a chin. And so while you're listening, you know, and just so Google the crowned face, NASA, Mars, and you'll see this image. And what's intriguing about the face on Mars and the crowned face is how human-looking the faces look. You know, they don't look like the reptilians that people talk about, you know, or the greys or anything like that. They look like us, you know, this imagery and the Nefertiti picture, you know, the crowned face one, the face on Mars, the other ones. That is an important thing because it suggests, I wouldn't say against all the odds, but what it does demonstrate is that possibly the Martians were extremely similar to us in terms of their appearance. And, you know, that would be incredible if we did actually meet real Martians and, you know, apart from a few differences, they look just like us, you know. That's not necessarily what we're expecting to get, you know, but it might actually be, you know, what we will get. But again, yeah, I think that's an important thing, is that all of the imageries that we seem to see reflect how we look, you know.
Interesting. Is it true that the claim that NASA has sabotaged a number of Mars missions, I don't know who is claiming that, but I've heard that.
Well, yes. I mean, this actually goes back to the 1990s. And when it comes to this, I mean, you have a lot of people in the conspiracy field who have said one of two things. That, you know, a number of, in the 90s, a number of probes went wrong, you know, and each time, you know, they they were destroyed, or they, you know, they crashed and they stopped working. And the one sort of side of it all is that the Martians quite literally blasted them out of the sky, you know, because they knew that there was this this civilization, this warlike civilization from Earth coming to Mars, and they decided, you know, they were going to take steps and blow up our people, you know, or the craft, I should say. And then you've got the other side where there are, again, some conspiracy theorists who believe that the craft themselves may have been sabotaged so that we wouldn't find, you know, we wouldn't get to see the photographs and the footage. And so that it would be for that reason. Although some of these stories are interesting, and I talk about them in the book, this is where one particular angle where I kind of steer away. I think the likelihood is that, you know, we're going from like 40 million miles, you know, and we've got to get everything right, and we've got to get to this world, you know, and either land carefully or take pictures, you know, and et cetera, et cetera. So, but, you know, this is like a very, all of these expeditions to Mars are, you know, extremely dangerous in terms of, you know, hoping to get it right. It just needs one little thing, you know, to go wrong. And so for me, I personally go down the sort of like a more down-to-earth angle, the idea that this was not sabotaged by NASA. This was not Martians doing it to us. I think this was just, you know, misfortune due to the fact that, you know, you think of the sheer power and science and technology and, you know, brilliant minds to make this work. And then it's not just around the corner, it's 40 million miles away. You know, things like that, it wouldn't surprise me, you know, if we actually had more of these disasters, really.
Yeah. So one of the other things that really intrigued me when I was reading your book was the thing that happened on May 22nd, 1984, and the CIA remote viewing. You really have to talk about that, because that made fascinating reading.
Yeah, sure. Well, for people who may not know, remote viewing is the way of, like, using the human mind as a means to sort of see into the past, or also into the future and the present, and to use the human mind to sort of focus on one particular area or person and be able to essentially see what's going in that area, or even, you know, almost like your mind could sort of project, you know, into somebody's living room and almost sort of, you know, listening on the conversation, sort of really sort of like a, you know, high-tech sort of psychic spying, if you like. And from the early 1970s onward, the CIA got very interested and excited by this field of remote viewing. And essentially they started by using psychics to try and focus their abilities on, like, where there might be some underground Chinese missile systems or Russian nuclear weapons, where they were buried, you know, in bunkers underground. And the CIA would have them to try and find, you know, the locations and, you know, what their capabilities were. But in, as you said, May 22nd, 1984, for reasons that we really don't know even now, what happened was that the CIA ordered a number of their remote viewers to focus all their attentions on the planet Mars. And this is important because this had nothing to do with NASA. You know, this is an important thing to just to mention before we actually get to the story. You know, NASA is sort of perceived and is, you know, the major agency on the planet that deals with, you know, space missions, astronauts, and so on. And yet, this particular program, May 22, 1984, had nothing at all to do with NASA. In fact, NASA was totally out of the loop, and this was being done by the CIA, which of course is not, you know, a space agency. It sort of works in, you know, sort of spying and espionage and things like that. But nevertheless, in May 84, this program went ahead when they brought in remote viewers, and they had this angle of going back round about sort of a million years ago, and just to see what the remote viewers could see back then. And lo and behold, the ones they were using came up with very similar scenarios where Mars was in this sort of state of almost like complete collapse and disaster, again, as if something had happened, like a worldwide, a planet-wide event had occurred to Mars that, you know, destroyed it, or at least significantly destroyed it to, you know, to a large degree, and that they were focusing their minds on what was going on, and they could see these Martians fleeing for, like I mentioned earlier, like sort of giant bunkers, which you would assume, you know, they had enough time to build them to get under the ground and flee. And what's interesting is that the remote viewers said that when they were able to see these Martians sort of fleeing underground as Mars started to spiral into this state of disaster, that they looked very much like us. In fact, really, really similar to us, but to anywhere from about 12 to 14 feet tall. Now, if you were to see them, that'd be pretty, you know, sort of imposing. If you, you know, you walk, you sort of, you know, seeing these images on Mars of Martians that kind of look like us, but they're sort of, you know, twice the height of the average human person, you know. And again, one of the things I talk about in the book is these stories, you know, in sort of ancient books, you know, the giants coming down to Earth, that kind of thing. I sometimes wonder, you know, if the, you know, you can look at these old legends, these old texts, textbooks, things like that, and then, you know, you've got the stories now coming from the CIA of these giants on Mars fleeing somewhere else. Now, whether the remote viewers didn't really have any kind of angle as to whether the Martians had, you know, fled their planet for Earth, but there was a lot of discussion of them, you know, having these underground massive ancient chambers where they could, you know, hide out for who knows however long. But yeah, that's one of the most fascinating aspects in the history of the mystery of Mars, because to this day, we don't know why exactly the CIA wanted that project to go ahead. What it suggests is that there was something else must have gone on, and something that the CIA must have known about that led them to initiate that program. It's not like, you know, the CIA gets up, you know, CIA agents don't get up in the morning and just say, oh, I think I'm going to remote view Mars today, you know. You know, they do it because, you know, they've got like a boss above them who says, you know, this is what we need to do today. And the big question is, so why, you know, why did the CIA decide to investigate Mars? There must have been something prior to that, whether days, weeks, or months before that, where something else popped up, and then they realized we need to get a handle on this. And that's probably what happened on May 22, 1984. But the images were really of like a total Armageddon. You know, apparently there was like these, the atmosphere was on fire, and it really was spiraling down, you know, to its last vestiges of whatever was going to be left, you know.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're talking about the giants, and the first thing that came into my head was maybe the Nephilim. And then in the chat room, we just got a comment that says we found many giant skeletons here on Earth, though the vast majority were destroyed by the Smithsonian in the early 20th century. I mean, there's just so many different possibilities, you know, with that, just that in itself, you know, if we found a 12-foot skeleton, you know, well, I think people would freak out, and they probably would.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, you're right there. But I mean, if you look in ancient history around the world, you know, you find numerous stories of legends, you know, in relation to giants. I mean, you've got like the Nephilim, the Anunnaki. You've got King Gilgamesh, who lived part of what is now Iraq. And he was said to be like a demigod. A demigod is sort of like a cross between a human and a god. You know, it's like a cross of the two. And Gilgamesh, he reportedly lived to, in our years, to around 130 years. So he clearly wasn't a normal human. And he was said to be around about 10 feet high. And maybe the fact that, that he was just a demigod rather than a god, you know, suggests there may have been sort of like a, you know, cross reproduction. You know, it sounds controversial, but maybe there was a possibility where, you know, the Martians and the humans were close enough to mate, you know, reproduce. And so again, that goes down a sort of another angle, sort of expands in relation to all of these stories around the world of the giants. You know, and it's hard to dismiss these stories because they are all around the world, and, you know, and it's not like back then they had the internet or TV or whatever, you know, and yet all around the world you can find these very similar stories.
And one more thing I want to ask before we get carried away here, literally off the air. I want to talk about the Martian-Tesla interaction that you wrote about, because that was really interesting as well. Was Tesla in communication with Martians, do you think?
So you broke up a little bit there. Could you say that again, Mark?
I'm talking about the Martian-Tesla interaction that you wrote about in the book. Was Tesla in communication with Martians, do you think?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's an important angle because, you know, this demonstrates how a lot of these stories, before we sort of just get to the story, demonstrates, you know, the fact that we've got like an ongoing, enduring series of mysteries and histories in relation to Mars. You know, we're talking about now, today, you know, we're talking about Mars, what's going on Mars. They were doing that back in the 70s. And now, as you mentioned with Tesla, you know, we're talking, you know, sort of more than a century ago, that kind of thing. So, you know, it's fascinating because, you know, you've got more and more of these kind of stories surfacing up. And one of the most significant ones, as you mentioned, was Nikola Tesla. And he was without doubt, you know, one of the most finest scientists of his era. There's no doubt about that. And he was, you know, working on all sorts of different technologies. Some of it would clearly, you know, would lead to things like free energy and things like that. And when he died in 1943, the vast majority of his papers and files were confiscated and were not seen again. And but what's particularly intriguing is that there was this sort of jaw-dropping situation in the early part of the 20th century when Tesla believed that he was actually being contacted by Martians and, you know, sort of getting imagery and almost like, you know, the sort of a voice. I won't say voice, you know, specifically, but he was getting imagery and thoughts as if they were being sort of inserted into his mind to allow him to become more and more acquainted, you know, with the Martians. He actually believed that he was, to some degree, communicating with Martians. And, of course, you know, a lot of the scientists of his day just sort of rolled their eyes. But, you know, he really was, you know, a brilliant scientist, way ahead of just about everybody, working a lot of alternative areas and had this connection with the Martians. And some researchers think that, you know, that possibly they somehow influenced him, you know, to sort of go down the path that he went through. You know, maybe it wasn't just him doing it. Maybe the Martians were even pulling the strings, you know, to actually put him in the position that he came to take, you know, one of the world's most brilliant scientists.
Yeah, so the Tesla coil could be the Martian coil for all we know.
Well, yeah, this is one of the interesting things, that a lot of the things that that Tesla did develop did come from his mind. And so you could make a case, well, if it came from his mind, then maybe it was put in his mind by the Martians. And as I said, there was, you know, this was in all the newspapers at the time in the early 20th century. And, of course, the more down-to-earth scientists looked away from it and didn't want to know. But, you know, I think that's sort of a tragedy. We should have, you know, sort of dug further and further, and maybe, you know, back even then we might have found something more.
I definitely agree on that. You know, we haven't been able to scratch the surface in this short hour, so people are just going to have to go out and get the book. And if people are kind of not wanting to read, I think I saw on your website or your Facebook page that the book is also available on Audible for people who would prefer to listen.
Yeah, it's in paperback, it's in Audible, and it's actually coming out in a box set CD collection for people who still like CDs.
Oh, wow.
And,
retro.
Yeah, so, yeah, and the company that makes them, or published this one, New Page, they've done quite a few of these now where, you know, they do sort of like a nice sort of box set with a different cover from the paperback. So, yeah, there's several different, there's Audible, Kindle, paperback, and CD. So however you want to read it, you can basically do it. So.
Flip a coin.
Yeah, there right. You go, yeah.
Yeah, now, you're such a prolific author that I can't keep up with all your new books and stuff, but I did think the latest one is Diary of Secrets, UFO Conspiracies, yeah. And the Death of Marilyn Monroe, Mysterious Death of Marilyn Monroe.
Yeah, that one just came out in May, and people ask me, how do I write them so quick? I always say I've got like 10 clones on me, but I don't really.
I think you're part Martian is what I think, but, you know, we won't tell anybody.
Well, I wish they'd take me there and I could have a look at it if I am.
Well, you're kind of tall, you know. I mean, not 12 feet, but anyway.
No, I'm not quite 12 feet, but I am 6'2 and a bit.
See? Mm-hmm. All right. I'll just keep that in mind. Where can people find out more about you and the events that you'll be out in the next few months and any other pertinent information that you'd like to share?
Yeah, sure. I have a blog called World of Whatever. So if you just Google Nick Redfern, World of Whatever, they'll take you to my blog. I'm always happy to chat with people. And, you know, if they got questions, just click on and I'll be happy to, as I said, answer. Or if they've got any worries or concerns, or they've had an encounter, you know, also always happy to chat. And you can also reach me at Twitter, Nick Redfern UFO, and you can also see me on Facebook as well. You won't miss me. And the next book, which has just come out about 6 weeks ago, called Diary of Secrets, and this is a full length book on a story that over the years has been, really hasn't been much touched at all. It started to surface in the mid-1990s, but a lot of people who started to get into it just backed away from it. They thought it was too over the top or whatever, but I didn't. I thought, I'll just keep digging and digging. And the book basically...
make it a quick tease.
What's that?
I said, make it a quick little tease.
All right. Yeah. It's about the possibility that Marilyn Monroe may have been murdered for what she knew about UFOs that had come from the insiders in the U.S. government.
Okay. You know what? I may have you back to talk about that if you don't mind at some point, because that sounds really, really interesting. All right.
Oh, well, thanks.
Well, thanks for joining me tonight. I'm going to have to dig through some more books and find because you have so many that we want to talk about. But that one will be good. And I want to thank everybody else for listening in as well. And until next time, everybody, blessed be and merry meet again. Good night.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Stirring the Cauldron with Marla Brooks. Please join us again next week at the same time for another great guest and more cauldron stirring. Any rebroadcast or other use of this program without explicit permission is strictly prohibited.